ideas or concepts or issues or concerns you have with the bond fund. But it is for you to know what's going on with activity in the bond oversight committee. So if you look at the agenda, you will notice the outline for all that's happening and how we proceed with our discussion. We would ask that for anyone who would like to testify or have any comment, that you sign up in order to do so. We'd love to hear from you. With that being communicated, let's get rolling. Our minutes. Have you had a chance, committee, to look over the minutes? And if you have any corrections or additions or questions, let's cover that. Should have them sent out.
Yeah, they were emailed last week, but they're not in the packet. But I can.
They looked fine to me.
Perfect. Excellent. So we will accept the minutes as presented and keep moving. So Shannon, you're going to give us some bureau updates.
Certainly. I wanted to make sure. I think you all know. That Director Krieger has decided to leave the Portland Housing Bureau as of last Friday. The mayor's office has asked me to step in as interim director, and we wanted to assure you that there will be we will be the affordable housing bond is one of the mayor's top priority. Not that he doesn't have other priorities, and that we will have continuity in our work together. I will not be stepping out of my role and guiding and helping the Bureau with the delivery of the bond, even though I'll be undertaking new tasks in the interim as well. So I just wanted to make sure you were aware, I think you all are, and give you an opportunity to ask any questions if you might have anything you wanted to address right now.
No questions.
I mean, I guess the only question is, do you see this impacting the work that we've been doing over the last few months, and if so, how?
No, I don't. I will remain and continue to remain an active member of the bond team. It's too important and too new of work together to step back from. But I also realize that we have a lot of good staff, and we're starting to put teams together to work very well moving forward on the bond. You see, obviously, the Javier Mena, the assistant director here, as well as Carl Dinkenspiel and Jennifer DeVisha. I'm not sure if you've all had a chance to meet Emily yet. Emily is a very active member of what we like to call ourselves is Team Bond. Emily has been producing a lot of the background materials for the property searches, which you'll see in your packets today, as well as helping us on data collection to guide some of our work, both in terms of property selection and in terms of some of the stuff you'll see today for the Ellington. So, no, I mean, this is top priority for this Bureau, the mayor, and personally myself.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Shannon. Since we have no other questions from the Oversight Committee, we're going to move to the update on property acquisition, the request for interest. We talked about this the last time we were together, and there is some further information and clarification that we will spend some time on today. So, Shannon and Carl.
So before we go in, I do want to say that we will need to address the quarterly meeting dates with you for next year. We'd like to get those in place. Jennifer has some material in your packet. I apologize for skipping over that, about some proposed dates and times, and we'll have to discuss with you in your schedule.
Yeah. So there's just a one page here where we were looking back at the calendar for 2018 and would like to propose these revised dates for the quarterly meetings, particularly to adjust around holidays, because a couple of them were kind of right adjacent to right after the holidays. And so we'll email this out to you tomorrow morning and give you some time to look over them. And then once we confirm with all the members, we'll get it solidified and get out meeting calendar invites to all of you as the updated quarterly meetings for next year. So thanks for your patience with the scheduling.
I noticed we were just joined by the mayor's policy advisor for housing, Mr. Alexander. And I know that we just had a very long meeting with the mayor this afternoon and talked about a number of his priorities, including the housing bond, and he had some particular ideas that he wanted to have you consider. So I thought, Cupid, if you, regarding the community the community engagement and potential evening meetings. So.
Oh, yes. So for as far as outreach and getting a response from the community members in regards to what the Bond Oversight Committee is doing, he would like this group to consider having at some point an evening meeting, maybe regionally located, so individuals who are interested in what the city is doing has the opportunity to not only address you, but to hear and get an update of what's going on. Because the bond is his number one priority, especially how it's moving forward. He would like you to consider that alternative in 2018. It's just more of an accessibility and community-focused engagement opportunity, and he would at least like you all to consider that as the schedule allows. So we're really trying to be as transparent as possible, and I don't know if you know this, but we get a lot of emails and calls and requests about the work that you all are doing. So we want to be sure that we're sharing this information because people feel a sense of ownership over these dollars. And we would like to share that information with them as possible. Steve Green.
Yes, sir. So do you see that being something that's separate from the quarterly meetings? And we do something specific that's really more community focused? Or do you see one of these quarterly meetings being moved to being a night meeting?
Yeah, I see one of the quarterly meetings being moved to a night meeting possibly. Okay. So not to add a lot more meetings to the schedule, but to keep in with a quarterly focus, but with a regional and hopefully evening meeting at one of them. Thank you.
I mean, that sounds totally fine with me. I mean, I imagine there's going to be a little bit back and forth. I imagine it might be a little bit of a longer meeting, but I'm down to work on that.
Yeah, I agree. I think the more engagement we have with folks, that it's difficult to get downtown for a lot of the folks that live in Portland, especially East Portland,
yes.
North Portland. It can take a while. So, yeah, finding a way to make it accessible and I fully support that.
Were you thinking specific areas so like East Portland?
Well, I know we want to focus on East Portland. I don't think it's any news to anyone at this table, especially that East Portland is very focused on seeing housing solutions and may feel like they are underserved. So us having at least the first meeting in East Portland, I think, would be prudent.
Could you have staff or the mayor's office offer up which one of the upcoming ones would work in
sure.
place?
Sure, I'll work with Jennifer and Shannon on determining when that would be appropriate.
Okay, I think the earlier heads up better, but I don't see it being a problem.
And just for clarity's sake, when we did have our check-in, the mayor's interested in scheduling a time that he can be here with you all. So we're going to be working with his scheduler on getting him at this table at least for 15 minutes to a half an hour to get some updates and address some of the concerns that individuals might have. So we'll be working on that.
Thank you.
He tried to come over this afternoon, but apparently his schedule didn't allow for
that. Triple book.
Okay.
Perfect. It's on you and Carl.
It's on Carl and I. As we had talked about at our last meeting, we addressed the issue of an internal and process for reviewing bond properties that were coming in under the RFI. We have had one review panel meet on December 1st. Stephen Green and Jessica Larson were your participants. As you may recall, you asked to have two BOC members on a revolving basis. And so Justin and Stephen did participate in one property review. And Alan and Todd are slated to do a second property, a second review panel with us this Friday. If you'd be so kind, we'd like to go through high-level results of what we've received under that RFI and a little bit of our learning to date. We will not be addressing property addresses. Some of the properties are still at play for us in terms of things we may be looking at purchasing, and obviously announcing purchases or potential purchases or purchase prices in a public forum would potentially jeopardize our ability to move forward on those properties. So with that, I will turn it over to our Housing Investment Preservation and Portfolio Manager, nice. Carl Lichfield.
Carl, you're hip.
I'm in. All right. I am going to ask somebody to help me with this PowerPoint presentation, see if it's working.
It's just the touch of a button.
Oh, yeah. That's fantastic. Okay. So thank you for the introduction. I'm going to stand up so people can hear me, but I know my committee's here. So we released a RFI, request for interest, on the 23rd of October, I believe. The RFI, our previous director called it the opening of the transaction window. And I think what was meant by that was we would just simply be open for business, right? So we had been receiving informal presentations to us about, hey, do you want to buy my property? And we said, sure, we'd like to consider it, but we have to wait and sort of be do a more open process as sort of manner for BHB, like our typical kind of notice of funding availability, right? So we did something similar. We sent out this RFI. What's really in the RFI, and I don't know if we have much in the way of content in the slides here or not. I should have reviewed this better. But what's in the RFI is really a reflection of what the stakeholder advisory group said, right? So stakeholder advisory group said, here's all the things that we want you to consider in looking at properties, acquisitions, and you know they sort of gave it to us in a short and sweet kind of way. Like, we want to make sure that they're in high opportunity areas if they're if the projects or the properties are land acquisition, and we want to make sure that they're, if you're acquiring buildings, that they would be places where there's a high vulnerability rating. And the vulnerability rating and opportunity, do you guys want me to explain what those things are? You guys got them? Okay. So that's what's in the NOFA, the RFI, really brief, is we want projects that meet the bond SAG framework, and the two main criteria for location are this opportunity mapping and the vulnerability scores. And so what happened was, and this is on this page here, so what happened was we got a whole bunch of stuff mostly from brokers, and I think this totals about 65 submittals altogether. We had a form that was put together by Antoinette's team. Emily's here. We had a form that was put. Antoinette's there. Oh, I didn't see it. Thank you. So we had a form that was put together. Pretty much nobody filled it out. So we had, here's the address. I'd love to sell you my property. And so we filled out as best as we could what the information that we needed. Obviously, the main piece of information is where's it located, right? And we can figure out a whole bunch of stuff from the address. We did have a few submittals that addressed other things like, what's your vulnerability score? How big is the property? When did you buy it? How much did you pay for? What are the environmental features? Most people didn't do that. What we got was, like you see here, 45 buildings and 20 pieces of property. Those 45 buildings were, 28 of them were submitted by just one broker who had one portfolio. So it's a little bit misleading. Mm-hmm. A couple of the other things in that building acquisition, there were other sort of big portfolios, right? There were maybe 5 or 10 properties in there. So the submissions in terms of the people that submitted, there were maybe 10 or something like that. The land was a little different. I think those are all sort of onesies, if you will. Each individual owner or broker submitting one property. So what we did after that is my staff went and looked at all those for the criteria that are in the NOFA or in the RFI, and then screened those out. And what you can see below, those six eligible properties on each side is what we have looked at so far. And so we're in the we're just in the middle of the process right now, looking at some of those. We have we did make an offer, or at least attempt to make an offer on one of the buildings. So far, what we've heard is that that did not work out. That's one of the six properties on that list. We have at least two or three other buildings that we will be considering as a smaller group, as Team Bond, in the next week or so. And we also have one or two pieces of land out of that six that we want to examine. But just to be clear, that my staff has gone out and looked at pretty much every single one of these 65 in person, at least a drive-by. So
this is the next slide, is the locations.
Yeah. So this is the RFI eligible property location. This one is showing all the 12, right? Is that what this one shows?
Yes.
Is that right, Emily?
Yeah.
Okay. So those six and six land and buildings. This is the general location, and we talked about this before. We're not going to say in public where these are. I think it's absolutely right that we jeopardize our ability to negotiate on those if we reveal those locations to a public meeting. We know what they are, certainly. The map is just a generality. You can see that most of the stuff is actually in East Portland. And in fact, a couple of things that we're really serious about are east of 205. So I think that's good from a policy perspective. It's also good from a financial perspective, just honestly, that those properties are less expensive than stuff that's closer in.
Just so I have a mental picture, 205 was just west of Maywood Park, is that right?
Maywood Park is on the east side of 205.
So just my mental image.
Yeah. I think that, Emily, isn't that little white space
in
Maywood Park?
That's Maywood Park. Yeah.
So approximately five, or yeah. About half of them are east of
that
right.
One last one, yeah, Todd, right here. That's actually three, it looks like.
That's three of them. Okay.
Looks like it.
I got you.
That one very end one, I can barely make it out.
Gotcha. Yeah, I see it too.
And Todd, I think I want to check with you and maybe the whole committee. You know, we had heard, particularly during the division transit conversation, that there's a east of 205 rather than east of 82nd kind of question. I don't know if that checks out with you or not. Most of these are east of 205. I don't remember if there's anything that's between 82nd and 205, but I think from a policy perspective, that would be good to know if that matters at all.
Because 205 was essentially like 97 or something like that.
And I think there was sort of a policy question around people saying, well, that's great, it's east of 82nd, but it's what we really expect is if you're doing East Portland, it has to be east of 205.
So I think one thing that would be helpful on maps like this going forward is an overlay of other housing projects.
I think we have that right now. Not in this presentation.
So that is something that you mentioned in the first review panel, the internal review panel, that not all the BOC members were at, and we are incorporating that in all of the materials going forward in the actual property when we're looking at a particular.
I think that'd be really helpful, especially if we do a meeting with the public out in East Portland.
Absolutely.
So they can ask for comment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. But I still want to make sure we're good.
So there we had two topics that we wanted to bring up with you that are particularly related to what we have had experience with since opening this transaction window, and wanted to have an open conversation with you about things we're finding with some of our zoning restrictions that were in our initial RFI, and also about how quickly we're needing to move to potentially secure properties that are things we want to move forward with.
So I was trying to get the RFI itself to show here on the screen. Emily, is there something I got to do to switch to that? Yeah, all right, so what's that? Magic! So if you recall, I think all of you have seen this RFI.
if you recall, what we did was we put some tables here showing what the requirements are. And that's on the next page, I believe.
That's a lot of text.
Bear with me for a second. So, so one of the things that's in the R5, right, is basic minimum criteria for consideration. So what the first thing that we did as a staff is that we meet these criteria for buildings and land acquisition. And you see it's really super simple, right? Just 20 or more units, you know, is it in the city of Portland? Does it allow, if it's land, does it allow for 20 or more units? Can you actually sell it to us in 120 days? And then what the zoning is. Honestly, what we found was, so the zoning was a little bit of me interpreting what the SAG said. And what we found is for stuff that we actually got in, there was a number of properties that were zoned either R1 or R2. The reason I have excluded those is they're really not high density zones. They're sort of medium density zones. I think we've had a request for folks to add R1 and R2. I don't really see a problem with that, but we wanted to run that by you guys to see if you identified any issues there. So that's a question for the committee.
So it's both based on our experience with what we're receiving, and we actually got some feedback from member of PHAC regarding a lot of the zoning that's actually in the Cully neighborhood. And a lot of it is lower density, this R1 and R2. However, if we were to have a larger parcel, we would be able to build a development potentially that would make financial sense and fit with the SAG framework. You know, there are a handful of buildings that we may want to consider acquiring. So it's our recommendation that we change this. This was something we did internally, but before we made that change, we wanted to make sure that we were having an open discussion with you and letting you know where we agree with the recommendation. Living Cully had actually made this recommendation to us through a PHAC member. So
is this around a specific property, or is this around a bigger strategic?
It's not around an individual property. It's around a bigger. It's about making sure that we have a wide enough net to capture some that we're not artificially excluding a property that may actually fit the rest of the criteria, and also potentially excluding pockets of the city. We still want it. You know, we still have to meet the other criteria to have enough units to either develop or to acquire. But we have seen some things that we think would be at least of interest and warranting further conversation. So we're trying not to foreclose the door to something that we believe needs the SAG.
And we also have a couple of proposals that are out of zoning. It's both general and specific.
I'm sorry, hopefully this is not too in the technical weeds, but I'm not a zoning expert. So I'm trying to figure out what this means on like a practical scale. What's the next highest density is like RH?
RH, yeah.
Okay, so what's the difference in terms of scale for, I don't know, what's the average size of an RH?
Yeah, so you go from R, so if you had, let me do some math for you. So if you had a 10,000 square foot property that's zoned R2, you'd be able to do five units. If you had a 10,000 square foot property zoned RH, and I'm talking more generally, it would be 40-ish units, something like that.
So that's a big
huge difference. Yeah.
And R1 is one per thousand.
So that's 10,000 square feet of property would be 10 units.
So what size?
So that's part of your. So Todd, you're getting at sort of the underlying logic I used to exclude those in the first place.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, are the parcels that we're trying to capture with this, with including R1 and R2, large enough to still accommodate 20?
Yeah.
So units. Just, you know, to get a little bit to Stephen's question, you know, we have a couple of, you know, acre plus pieces of property that are zoned in the R1, R2 range, which would get us well over that 20 unit minimum. And I think I would also say, and I'm not the planner here, maybe Matt, you might know this answer, that there's some question about the housing, Better Housing by Design program, Matt, about taking those R1 and R2 zones and actually increasing the possible density 2 or 3 years from now. Yeah, you know, in some parts.
In some parts of the city, yeah. So while they may be sort of lower or medium density now, there is a possibility if that gets passed that these would be higher density.
My concern is from a neighborhood level, stuff that's R1, R2, there's a certain integrity of a neighborhood that people assume is happening.
Yep.
And if they have a big vacant lot that's, you know, huge enough, I worry about how those neighbors will perceive the impact of us coming in. But I don't think we should take anything, you know, definitively off the board. But I just think there's some externalities involved in doing a project like that that you don't have to deal with when you're working on someone's RH.
Any other thoughts from the committee about that idea?
Susan, it looked like you were going to.
I was just, I had the same question as Todd, you know, that you've set out the size, you know, you want to get to 20 units. And that was the question I had. Could you do it if you used R1 and R2? It sounds like you could in certain circumstances.
You could on a big enough piece of property, yeah.
So this is just, this change would just give you more latitude, but you're still going to be really scrupulous about looking at each.
I guess to clarify kind of what it means practically as well, in terms of heights, building heights are fitting with neighborhood characteristics. I guess my question is, like, if you put the buildings, like it's a very dense structure, that leaves more open space in these lower density zoning areas. Is that right? Or do the layouts have to change completely to accommodate that?
You know, I think from a constructability standpoint, you're right about leaving more open space.
Okay.
You know, I mean, we could have a sort of townhouse style development. I don't know that we do that. The rent line wouldn't exclude it necessarily completely, but you know, it's a fairly inefficient way to do rental housing.
Also likely to exceed some of the cost per unit we'd be able to achieve. I mean, that's a much more expensive way to build housing.
Yeah. I guess I'd be interested in kind of what Stephen says, well, like what surrounding neighbors like thought about things, or also if there's some sort of shared use that the neighbor can benefit from that extra open space.
Yeah, I think that's sort of a fine point that has to do with the specific development, right?
Yeah, right.
To me, this is just not like low-lying fruit. This is like when everything else has been done, it's like, all right, we're left with some stuff. And my first inclination is if something's 20,000 square feet and it's R1 and it hasn't been developed,
right,
there's already some other things at play there anyway.
Right.
So it just doesn't seem like it's a primary or secondary, even tertiary option. I assume there's properties like that exist. But
So no, but no strong objections to just including it in the list of possibilities. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Or is there a downside to including them?
I mean, no, I don't think there is. I mean, I think, you know, so you guys, whoever on our internal committee is going to see each individual acquisition, right? And you'll say, well, it's nice that you allowed that in the door, but given the specifics of the neighborhood, we really don't want you to go there. So the other question we want to talk about, letters of intent and purchase and sale agreement,
so,
possibilities.
Yeah, so what we, as I mentioned at our very first property review meeting on the 1st, between the time that we issued the agreed upon materials, which I've included a generalized view of what those materials look like for those of you who haven't gotten to participate in the panel. We did this for you a meeting ago on 30th and Powell. And we committed to distributing this information to the group on Monday and then meeting on a weekly basis if needed. I mean, we have a standing meeting if we need to on a Friday to review the property and make a kind of a green light decision that would then, you know, move forward ultimately to the mayor's office for us to be able to start the due diligence process. In that time period of the property that we reviewed, the building owner said that he was taking multiple offers 2 days before we were able to meet as an internal panel. And we wanted to bring up and address the very real issue that we may have to issue letters of intent before the property panel meets. We also want to make sure that you know we would not do that unless it met all of our criteria. Obviously, a letter of intent is not a binding agreement to sell, but it does give us the ability to start to negotiate. I think Stephen Green could talk more thoroughly about what we did at the last meeting. The group did green light that particular property, and for some reason it falls out of contract for consideration. But we wanted to be open with you about the fact that we may need to do that. And we've attached kind of a sample intent to purchase letter for you to have a general idea of what that may look like. So we want to be really transparent with everybody about what may be occurring and talk with you about that. Because quite frankly, we think this is going to come up more and more often. That before we officially move with our review panel, that properties will potentially be under contract with someone else, or at least entertaining. I mean, the parcels that we're most interested in, others are too. They're not waiting on us or our internal process to kind of have a dialogue about it. So, I'd let Carl or Stephen, who was actually a participant in the last panel, talk more about it. But we wanted to let you know that that we think that this is something we're going to need to do to make sure that we have an opportunity to buy properties or buildings.
Yeah, I think my two cents is just that you guys are going to go through all the same normal rigor. This is just basically a gate that you're able to open early on in the process, but it doesn't change any of the standards or ways that you look at the project. I think the other thing that needs to happen is people in the public sector, private sector, need to have expectation management done of what going down this road with the city, of what that means and what that doesn't mean. And so they're not going to get breaks on time frames or costs or anything like that. Like, we're dealing with taxpayer money, so no, Carl does not have a leprechaun at his office.
Loads of cash. I should get one.
So, and I think, we don't want to get in the way of things. I think we want to make sure the standards set forth by the SAG are followed, but we're the ones working with the least amount of information when it comes to these things. So I think we want to be informed and be part of the process, but, I'm all for, leveraging, finding these opportunities and being able to take advantage of them.
Yeah, and so just a little maybe history of the properties we've been considering, right? So obviously they have been, well, I shouldn't say obvious, the ones we have been looking at have been represented by brokers. Generally, it's sort of, as Shannon is saying, they have been competitive. The broker obviously has an interest in sort of pressuring us to make an offer quickly. It's hard to judge whether that pressure is real or not. The one that we looked at previously, it did seem real because the competing offer was accepted sort of simultaneously with our offer. So I think we have to be realistic that we should be able to act quickly when we need to act quickly. And like you said about the due diligence stuff, if we get into contract and stuff, we will do the best we can to negotiate as much time for due diligence as possible, particularly for occupied buildings. There's a lot of stuff to figure out.
What's your guys' feeling on opportunities for properties that aren't currently represented by brokers?
Yeah, so that was one thing I don't think is on the agenda, but I wanted to talk to you guys about that. We got this slug of stuff after the transaction window opened. There was a fairly limited set of representatives bringing us those. We have talked internally about doing a kind of RFQ for brokerage services. We think that would probably a good next step, not the only good next step, but one good next step, is to have a stable, if you will, of a couple brokers, three, four, whatever, that would be specifically charged with going out and, beating the bushes for us rather than the other way around. But I also feel like we need to identify stuff that we want to go after and, figure out how to make those contacts. So I think at this point, we're going to run through this group that we got, the first group, but we need the second group and the third group and the fourth group, and we're going to need multiple ways to go about that. So I think brokers will be one method, and our direct contact is going to be another method.
what do the direct contacts look like? What does that process
look like? So what I think we want to do, and this will be a little harder in terms of process, is we're going to want to take this overlay of what's in the SAG framework and the RFI, come back to you guys and say, we're going to go out and send staff, whoever it is, whether it's from us or some other organization, whatever it is, and actually go and identify specific pieces of property and then either contact those owners directly or have a third-party broker kind of contact them. You know, I think the other thing, you know, sort of a fourth way, if you will, is that, you know, we've had contacts in the community, like, for example, the Community Alliance of Tenants has said, hey, wait, you know, something's going on here. The owner is doing all sorts of stuff. We need you to get in on an emergency basis and see if you can start a conversation. So that would be another way to go about.
I think even in our last meeting, Todd, you know, I thought of three or four properties owned in different neighborhoods that they don't have brokers, but families have just been sitting on them for decades, and for one reason or another, there's really no financial incentive for them to do anything other than what they've done. And I think it's a great opportunity to go and work with those families and say, hey, this could be, you know, affordable housing in the community that you know and love, you know, for years to come.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we might, you know, rely on you guys, right? To say, hey, do you have contacts, or your contacts have contacts, to go and talk to the owners. That's sort of one flavor of that.
Well, we do have, you know, the SAG framework has asked us to try to make sure that we are looking at delivering on the bond in every jurisdiction, plan district, I believe it was called. And if you notice, we are not getting anything in certain parts of the city, particularly I'm thinking Southwest Portland. And that's an area that I think we need to really target some activity to drumming up some interest in properties that we may want to acquire. So I mean, that's, you know, for example, it may be a specific property or maybe, you know, broader than that, like actually seeking out a general area and giving some direction to brokers about what to potentially seek for us, you know, fitting in with the RFI conversation.
Cupid, do you think there'd be any demand from the mayor's office to talk to some of the other bureaus about properties in other areas?
So, you know, there are processes that are already in place as far as different availabilities within the city. I don't think that we would have a problem reaching out proactively. I think that, you know, one of the first things that we do is want to know what available property there are from, like, the Water Bureau and different other bureaus that would be available and zoned for a possibility of using as affordable housing. So I think that's reasonable, and we do have an appetite to do that. So we'll continue on that conversation.
And some of that's already happening as well. Yeah. Are there, that's what I got. Other things? Questions?
No. So how many more do you have for tomorrow's meeting or for Friday?
Two for Friday.
Two extra ones.
Two for Friday. And we have sort of two others that we won't formally present, but just want to talk about.
Were there surprises for you in the process?
People don't read the process, apparently.
There was no surprise for me in terms of that piece, which is no one really submitted the format. That was not a surprise. you know, I guess I was a little bit disappointed in the lack of geographic dispersion, honestly. You know, a lot of the properties were, you know, it's great from a policy perspective, but, you know, as Shannon said, there are parts of the city that were missing, you know, North Portland, Southwest Portland. Sort of closer in Northeast Portland was very much, you know, east of 205 was the really heavy emphasis. So that was not that surprised, but it's a little disappointing.
You know, it's also, I think, a good indicator of what, you know, these are properties that are on the market. People are actively marketing them. Yeah. So, I mean, these are some of them are vacant land, but a large majority of them are buildings. And so that means that these buildings are being flipped right now from long-term owners to potential new owners, which quite frankly usually means rent increases. So, you know, I think what the map's also showing us is that we have opportunities to try to prevent displacement, which is really a large part of what this bond is about. So, you know, it's a little different than maybe what we expected.
Another thing I'd say, I don't know if you guys talked about it on the previous Friday when I wasn't here, but so we did
we seriously looked at a couple other pieces of property besides the one that we made the offer on in that same vicinity. And I think I was a little, to answer your question, Susan, I think I was a little disheartened about the overall condition of the properties. So I don't want to sort of sugarcoat anything. It's like a lot of this stuff out there will need some significant help. And what I will say, having toured a few of the units, and I mean, this is completely offhand, but you know, just looking at where people are living and potentially who's living there, I think that it's going to be good that the city gets involved and potentially upgrades those properties and makes them hopefully better than what people are currently living in.
I think one of the other things that came out of the meeting was there's going to be a substantial need of kind of social capital come forward to really, you know, the status quo of sending out an RFI, RFQ, or whatever, it's probably not going to drum up the kind of stuff that we need to have happening. I think it's probably going to be some more heavy lifting on our parts.
Yeah. And that was not our partners. That was definitely not a surprise.
And this is probably not a great time to be going and saying we want to buy dirt. And the biggest boon in real estate history. But there was already some pretty creative ideas that I think came out of just that 2-hour meeting of things we were, you know, so yeah, that was good.
Yeah, good.
So is everyone satisfied with the approach, the concept?
I'm satisfied.
Yeah.
Carl is still not here.
Carl is still not here.
I'll never be as hip as you, man.
All right. Excellent. Well, now let's talk about, unless you have other things you wanted to go through, Carl.
Nope.
But fantastic. We are right on, we're a little early. It's exciting. Let's talk about the Ellington. Back to you, Shannon and Javier.
No, talking about challenges of trying to acquire property to a property that we actually acquired earlier this year. I know there's been a lot of questions as to what's happening there. Sometimes I have the same questions as to what's happening there. It's kind of interesting just going from a bureau that funds affordable housing to owning affordable housing. It's a different paradigm that we got to turn to. So the Ellington, just to recap, we acquired the Ellington on February 6th of 2017. It was a very quick due diligence and acquisition process that led us to the acquisition. We know that as we were looking at buying the property, there were already 44 units that, because of different lawsuits and other situations, were restricted already as affordable for another 30 years, I recall. And so we decided, because of where it's located, the size of the property, over 11 acres, and the vulnerability of the tenants, should this property be sold in a market, that it was a good opportunity. And so we went ahead and acquired the property. As you can tell, since the acquisition, we have the property was being managed by Guardian, and their contract expired on June 30th. And we were, when we acquired the property, we're negotiating a new contract with Affinity, and Affinity is a new property manager for the Ellington, and they have been managing the property since July 1st. And so there were some transition learning processes and hiccups and opportunities throughout the first 6 months at the Ellington, or 5 months. What you see there now is that as of today, 28 of the units are housing families that are at 0 to 30 that came through the family homeless system. And so, and these are units I don't know if you recollect, but we said 80 units of the 263 will be made affordable at 0 to 30. Of those 80 units, 52 were going to be project based Section 8 vouchers. And so we're still waiting for Hope Forward to work through that process and see how those units will be identified. But we did not want to wait until that process was done. We knew that there were some 28 units that we needed to make sure they were available to households at that income range. So we worked and it's a little later in the PowerPoint, but in a way to ensure that we begin to lease those units to those households. And as you can see, I think that's a success where we have 28 of those households that are now housed, that were previously chronically homeless. If we go to the next slide, in terms of some of the stuff we already knew, and it's just as we have begun to manage the building and better understand the tenants, it just comes through, it becomes a fact. So the length of residency, it's just over 2 years. When we acquire also the Ellington, our interest was not to displace anybody that was there already, and we needed to develop a policy as to how we would address residents and tenants that are living in properties that we acquire, and so that are over income, and so we're still developing those policies. And at this point, what we communicated to residents that whatever lease you're on, we will renew the lease if you want to continue to be there for another term, and then we'll hopefully by then we'll have some policy developed. But with that, as you can see, the tenancy is about 2 years, which has allowed for us to be able to. There's been some transition already on the property. So over 100 households have moved out, and we've put in new households through our own outreach process that we've agreed with Affinity. So I don't see any challenge, at least for the most part, of being able to transition what used to be a market rate housing into an affordable tenancy housing at the Ellington. It's stop me if you need to ask questions or I'm going too fast, or should we keep this going? In terms of the household composition, and when you did this, when we bought it, it's heavily a single person household at the Ellington. A lot of roommate processes, and some of them have begun to move out because they've lost roommates, they can't afford the rent. And there have been instances where a household, because of their income, can no longer afford the rent that's on that unit because still a market rate rent, that they've asked for accommodation into a smaller unit where they can actually qualify as affordable, and they're going through that process. So to the degree that we can, we try to accommodate the current tenants, and if they qualify, to see how we can roll it in within the current project. There's some part-time students there, and we knew that when we purchased the property, and as we move forward with the new tenancy, I perceive that to change to more family households with kids as opposed to what it is right now. It was surprising that even with 2 and 3 bedroom units, we don't have a lot of kids in the project. So. I mentioned the units. 80% of the units are two-bedroom units, and which is a very family-friendly build place. One of the areas that we know that we need to address is there's no place for kids to play. There's no place for kids to get together, and there's no play structure. Also, there's no meeting space for the residents. And so, as in the future, as we look at doing some type of renovation that we will have to do, that's one area that we need to address. We need to make it a little more family friendly than what it is right now. Some of the information in terms of the current tenants, most leases will expire in 2018. As I mentioned, 114 of those units are currently market, so they're paying market rents. And as those leases expire and we begin to really assess the income of those tenants and qualifications, we'll be transitioning those as needed.
So you said the ones that were, if they're up for their lease, they will be able to sign again for whatever their lease was before, and then we'd be talking about what their income is?
We will be looking at when they renew, we will be looking at assessing their income at that moment in time. So if they qualify, then we would be looking at, and let's say it is a 3-person household, it's a 2-bedroom, then we'll be looking at restricting rents for them, so lowering the rents for them because now they qualify based on their income. If they don't qualify based on income, then we would keep in the rents as is and extending the lease for another year. so that they can, they're not displaced, they can continue and hopefully look for alternative housing for the next year.
Gotcha.
Okay. So that's the idea.
Okay.
Well, we don't
so
want
they
to displace
either get a
anybody
year
right
more if they don't qualify, or their rent goes down.
Correct.
Based on qualifying income.
And if they are over housed, so let's say there's a one single that is a three bedroom, and they qualify based on income, we will put them on the wait list for a one bedroom or for a studio, so that we make that unit available for families and move that to a more appropriate housing.
Gotcha. Okay.
Could I just ask about the 28 where you got people at 30% of AMI and you didn't use project-based vouchers, so did they come with a tenant-based voucher, or how did you get those 28 to be affordable?
Remember, there is no debt except for, right now,
oh.
We don't have a loan on the property.
So you were able to just lower the rent.
Right now we are.
Oh, wow, okay.
We are interest to be, we still owe $10 million on from that acquisition that we have to pay the Bureau of Development Services. And so we're looking at putting some debt on the property. And we think that even with the 28 restricted units, we'll be able to do that.
And then the other thing, when it showed average tenancy of being a year, an average tenancy of a year, it seems like the plan to eventually get it to meet what the bond requirements are will happen because people are moving out,
right.
It looks like.
Yeah.
Even if you're committing to another year, it looks like you're going to really be able to transition this property just because of average tenancy not being very long.
Right. And
historically.
And you also just have to remember the history of this project. So. It had gone through a few lawsuits over the past 5 years. And after the final lawsuit that restricted 44 units, the owner was actually paying out to tenants to move out $10,000. So they were already in a transition mode, but it was for the opposite reason. It was wanted to make a lot of the units market units and you know, increase the rent. And so this property has been in transition over the past 2-3 years. So I think that, but once we are able to stabilize it with affordable households, I don't see this continuing being a 1 year turnover ratio.
So I guess I foresee some sort of, if we do a East Portland meeting, maybe a resident or two that's being impacted by this, talking about potentially their experience. You know, if someone's got some cost savings that are going to be happening, or. Maybe just give some context. I continue to read the newspapers and a lot of blowback. People think that, we're just sitting on our hands. But I think it's always better if you can put a face and a name and, some people that are literally talking about how this is impacting them.
Right, and I would say, a lot of these pictures, these are actually residents from the island. And Jennifer can go into this as we talk about some of the agreements that we've had. But we have attempted to do press releases with residents and talk about their experience at the Ellington. So most definitely would love to do that. So as we look at moving forward with the Ellington, we are looking at 183 units will be available at up to 60% AMI and 80 units at 0 to 30. We talked about the 28 units that are already at that level. There'll be 52 project-based Section 8 vouchers. Home Forward has to go through this competitive process to allocate the project-based units. We will be asking them as to where they are with that process, and then they have to first make those options available to current tenants and see if they qualify. And if they do, then that kind of already directs as to which units will be restricted, and then whatever has not been allocated, then we need to be able to allocated based on, we want to make sure that it's proportionate to what the bedroom count is. So we want to make sure that there's some three bedroom that are 0 to 30 as well as some of the one bedroom. So that's the goal on the vouchers. And 20 of those are PSH units as well and with the services. How we have been able to get here has been a lot of work. Jennifer has done a lot of work with Affinity and with our partners as to how do we create this, some type of agreement between the property management company and our service partners to lease these units. And you want to talk about the,
yeah.
Or I can continue?
Do you want to do this last?
Oh, so One of the challenges that Affinity has had is a lot of the demographic information in their systems, and it's a system challenge, is aggregated. So we don't have a per unit run us through the demographics of the residents. Also, there's a large number of unknowns. When we receive the demographic information, I would say, it's about 355 residents that we don't have any from any demographic information at all. And so we are working with them to be able to get that information so we have are able to better explain as to who is living in these units. At this moment in time, we don't have that, but we're working with Affinity to get there.
And that's really based on the fact that these were market rent apartments and it wasn't something that they would have collected at the point of tenancy. So we're just dealing with the fact that it's a private market.
Okay. Thanks,
Javier. So Javier mentioned a lot of the work that we've been working coordinating with the property management company, which is Affinity, and reminding and kind of relooking at the bond SAG framework, which had some really specific policy objectives connected with it. We've been looking to align those policy priorities with the current work at the Ellington. And so there's three to four main things. First was to align the housing with the homeless service system, so homeless service providers and partners as a referring source into a lot of the available housing, particularly the 0-30% AMI units. Another was around focused outreach to reach priority populations and communities around available waitlist openings or vacancies. Another is to include supportive housing opportunities. You know, as we look to the different properties and housing that we're creating under the bond, we also have a focused goal of reaching at least 300 supportive housing units. So we'll need to be looking both at the Ellington as well as future properties, how to incorporate that in. And then reduce barriers for tenant screening as an important priority. So I just want to cover each of these and work that we've been doing up to this point. So to begin with the alignment of the homeless services system, we've executed and completed a memorandum of understanding, an MOU, which is kind of a three-way partnership between the city, the property management company, and then also the homeless families system of care mobile housing team. So through the Joint Office of Homeless Services, there is a network of homeless service providers, and they're called the mobile housing team, and they do a coordinated access system around families that are looking for housing and eligible for housing. And many to all of them are connected in one way to a social service provider and receiving some type of support through them. So we have this MOU now in place with the mobile housing team being the primary referring source in for 0-30% AMI vacancies. And then there's a list of the different partners of the mobile housing team, seven home service providers. I had just seen Patricia walk in, and she's with El Programa, but they're one of the partners in that team. And then they've made 13 direct placements, and then there's 10 to 15 that are on the 0-30, as well as the 60% wait list for upcoming vacancies that come up. So that's for that. And then moving on, just the outreach to priority communities. We worked with Affinity to give them a list of outreach contacts to notify when their wait list for the 60% units becomes, I guess, exhausted, when they don't have any other households on the wait list. And so the list of the partners are here on this slide, several different culturally specific organizations and agencies that are serving immigrants, refugees, and people experiencing homelessness. And Affinity, when their wait list for becomes where they need to open it, they will contact these partners first, and we'll have a 2 to 3 week window of time for these agencies to make referrals or pre-applications to the wait list. After that time, if they have not received enough households for the wait list, they will open it up to a broader the public list, including, you know, Craigslist, other kind of notification venues. So that's what we currently have in place. Would love to hear your suggestions on to if there are additional partners or processes to improve upon this. We just wanted to get this in place and have it in place and know that we can continue to work with them on this. And
so is there any sort of exchange or is there a customer relationship management system that all these organizations use? So like if I go to Black Parent Initiative mm-hmm. and I get on their list, if Latino Network sees an opening, do they know that I'm on a list for BPI? I mean,
So Affinity, as a property management firm, manages the wait list for the 60% units. So it's a, when they open the wait list, they then receive referrals in a first come, first serve basis, right? Unless we tell them otherwise, based on households that submit what they call pre-applications. It's kind of a simple one page thing to get onto the wait list. These organizations wouldn't necessarily know who's on that. They wouldn't know who else is referring into the wait list, I guess, unless they, I don't think the wait list is made public. I don't know.
So is the wait list all of Infinity's properties, or is it just one
it's
project?
Just it's specific to the Ellington.
So Infinity could have like 10 different wait lists for 10 different properties?
Yes. Or each project they have?
I think each project they typically maintain separate.
And so if I'm looking for a property, I would have to go and put myself in each one of their waiting lists?
Yeah.
Until we have launched our one app Oregon
process. This is ridiculous.
I mean, I think this is like the intent of why, you know, the city has invested and partnered with One App Oregon, you know, who's working on a standard application that then links you to eligible properties and vacancies within that. I think we're about 2 to 3 months away from that being ready, you know, and available in our community.
Can you say anything more about that?
Yeah.
I'd be interested to know as this plays out, and I don't know if Affinity would be willing to do this, what kind of response they get when they open the window and they say, okay, we have units. I'd be interested to know which of the organizations respond and get referrals.
We've asked them to track it.
Okay.
Yeah, and so they, as part of the pre-application to get on the wait list, we have, they're asking people, were you referred from one of the below or another social service agency? If so, you know, mark it. I mean, the household can voluntarily add that. But that's something we definitely want to track too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there, I mean, you mentioned that there's room for more partners for folks. Okay. So we would just ask, if we can think of some partners, tell them to get in contact with you or PHP in general. Who specifically?
Both Shannon and I. And
I would right now make
Jennifer would be the best contact.
Yes.
And I, you know, I think we have prioritized the 0 to 30 units, though, specifically for the homeless family system at this point. But the ones above, 30% to 60%, we're looking for organizations that meet the criteria in the same framework.
Yeah, and then I think what is particularly helpful too is to have the contact person within the organization, because with each of these, Michelle, in particular, as our outreach and community engagement manager, has coordinated, has spoken with them to identify the, you know, they know the staff person and have given them, we've given them notification to expect information from the Ellington when the wait list comes open. But so having a contact person at an agency is also is particularly helpful too.
Is this going to be a similar process for all properties that are developed or acquired by the bond money? I'd be more more pressed to tell people to get engaged with this if there was more than this was going to happen with more than one project.
In all regulated units,
right?
Not just bond, but every regulated unit would be part of one app, correct?
That's our intention. Every regulated unit will be part of the One App Oregon. The question around our outreach list, I think it is our intention to have focused outreach contact lists for bond, for housing related to the bond, because of the intent to strategically reach out and make vacancies available to focused communities.
And that would even be my one caveat, even with One App Oregon, and I know that's not the topic of conversation, but there are projects and placements that are very specific populations that we're trying to have that may not go broadly. They wouldn't go out on a Craigslist, they wouldn't go out on a One App Oregon.
Yeah.
So I just want to caveat that, because I know we're talking about that a lot, and we kind of say everything's going to go on One App Oregon, but when we're really trying to do a targeted population, maybe there's DV victims or housing for survivors. I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page that, we do have other shared priorities in some of the housing.
Yeah, I think that's a question I have for the committee. We want to have focused and intentional marketing and outreach by the various properties. And it's going to look, so this list is for the Ellington. It has a lot of family size units. It's in, the location. We know where it is. But there might be other properties in the future that the bond pays for that's maybe focused on, single adults. So the outreach contact list may be different because it's, going to be focused around who we intend to serve in the housing. So
is geographic preference going to be, I don't know if there's legal prohibitions on geographic preference, but one of the targets is preventing displacement, and I know we've talked about school boundaries in the past, and I'm just wondering if we know that a new property or acquisition is happening in a certain neighborhood, are families that are interested that are from that are having their kids and going to the local school going to have any sort of preference?
That's a great question. Okay. I don't know the answer.
I'm not
to
sure
that.
How you do that outreach, but I think that sounds like we want to be part of the outreach process.
Yeah.
It's part of that. It's targeted outreach, right? Okay. As we, and not necessarily preclude for anybody from applying. It's more about providing information in a targeted place.
I hate to interrupt, but prior to our chair needing to go, there's another issue that needs to be addressed. We'll come back to this. You can interrupt the process. Shannon wanted to.
So I did want to draw everybody's attention to the second, and we can finish the Ellington PowerPoint. What is entitled Next Steps for the Ellington Asset Management. We had talked about this at a prior meeting, but I wanted to make sure I gave you an update in a very public way. The Housing Bureau has been acting as a asset manager of the Ellington for since February. It is not a function that we have maintained before in-house. Asset management is kind of that layer between the time you develop and the actual property manager. It's looking at the long-term health of the building. It's dealing with setting up appeals processes, helping determine rehab issues, you know, a lot of different things that go into an actual ownership. And as Javier said, we have not technically, except for a couple of properties, been actual owners, nor have we been asset managers. So we have been engaging in a dialogue with our government partner, Home Forward, being our asset manager for the Ellington and potentially the rest of our bond portfolio going forward. They are the only entity that government entity that manages affordable housing at that asset management level. It will not change any of our policy framework, but I want you to know that that's occurring, and remind you again that I think we'll actually be bringing something to City Council as soon as January of this year. So I wanted to make sure I mentioned that to you on the record while I still have three BOC members in the room.
Would they be taking over from Affinity or just doing oversight of Affinity?
Oversight of Affinity.
Okay, so, just because of their expertise and knowledge, and they know that world.
Yes, yes.
Will there be any potential pushback from other organizations that do asset management?
You know, I think that there, I don't know that, I think some people think that there could be roles for asset management. We're looking for someone to manage the portfolio of ownership for us, and we have very few options for that. It really does come down to us with a government partner. We're not, there is no one that we know of that does a large portfolio at that level of affordable housing except for their own portfolio. The government relationship has certain benefits to us, both in terms of assignment and liabilities. Oh look, we're trading off
the other side.
So yes, I mean, I think that people have been seeing that as a potential role, but you know, if we get a constitutional amendment, we don't plan to be owners, and we would not like to build this capacity in-house. I mean, that's really what it comes down to for us, is building this capacity in-house or going with...
Oh, he's not coming.
Yeah. Or going with Home Forward. So we can. I'd be happy to talk more, but I wanted to make sure I let you know where the status update was.
Thank you.
I'll wait for an email about the quarterly meeting updates.
Yes.
When that's going to be.
Yes, sir.
And then let me know how Friday goes.
All right.
We will.
Perfect. See you.
Thank you.
See you.
All right. Back to you.
Yeah, okay. So moving on to supportive housing, we want to, you know, we have a goal of reaching 20 supportive housing units at the Ellington. We're our primary partner in helping do this is going to be through, again, the homeless family system. There are several resources through the Joint Office of Homeless Services, one being a pilot team of a mobile permanent supportive housing services team that has been funded and can then work to provide supportive services with households who need it at the Ellington. And so I know that they're in the process right now of identifying those tenants, those families and individuals that have been recently placed, and seeing and assessing if they have services needs that can be provided through this mobile team. So again, the goal of having 20.
And yeah. We do already have how many families?
It's about 10 or 11 identified, yeah, already, yeah. And then finally, just reducing barriers to tenant screening. As Javier mentioned, we have regular meetings with Affinity, and we're working with them to propose and changes around and getting a finalized tenant selection plan in place that helps to address reduced barriers in screening, particularly you know, related to just households that may have some barriers to housing or screening. And so we're working with them on that and aiming to get something finalized by next month, hopefully. And I think, I don't know, maybe Shannon and Javier can talk about the conversations about some of the particular criteria, or if you have anything. Some around, yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. I think we can, but Jennifer's doing a great job in working in the interim on that. I think we've done a good job to reduce barriers in the interim, and while we work on a complete policy for tenant screening, and as you said, I mean, it may be different for different buildings and different populations, One of the things that we have made an internal decision about is that we will not be requiring repayment of property debt as a condition of tenancy. I don't know if that's an issue that folks are aware of or not, but many times when you're applying for an apartment, first you have to meet whatever the tenant screening criteria is, and then if you for some reason had a previous property debt, that could be unpaid rent, it could be a small amount of damage, it could be any number of things. It's industry practice to require repayment of that debt. To even though you've passed the screening, you mm-hmm. now have to repay that property debt. And what we know is that for a lot of families who are in the homeless family system, they may have had they may have left quickly. They're homeless, right? They don't have a forwarding address. They didn't know how to necessarily appeal. They've had some kind of an issue, and now we're essentially acting as a credit collection agency. So we've made a commitment to not following that policy. It's industry standard on our bond properties. We think it creates an unnecessary barrier to housing that, quite frankly, we're paying for anyway with the homeless family system. You know, in terms of getting folks into housing, I'm sure Susan, you probably have some experience with that. So
in terms of the tenant screening, as you move forward to try to get Home Forward to be your overarching asset management, will you be determining those tenant screening criteria? And then they'll just be enacting them with whoever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and so related to that, we are, our policy team and the bureau staff at large are working on drafting screening criteria specific for the bond. This was one of the follow-ups from some of the work with the stakeholder advisory group, and that we are drafting it, and then we'll be reviewing it with other partners to get a pretty broad base of feedback on them before finalizing. And so we'll make sure to include this committee and each of you in reviewing those drafts. You know, it should, we have to get them ready in the next week or two and have at least a month or a little more to receive feedback on them. And we're working very closely with Home Forward to understand what they have, you know, obviously in place. But we will be setting the criteria and then working with them to implement it. Yeah.
So, any other questions?
Just on the timing, Javier, when you were talking about Home Forward working out the plan of how they're going to do these project-based vouchers, what do you see that to be like a year-long process?
You know,
is it hard to say?
Had you asked me when we bought it, I would have said by the end of this year I would have some idea. I don't know. And
yeah.
I know that they have challenges as well with the budget and some of the other things that they had to address with vouchers and federal things that are going at the federal level. So at this moment, I don't know, and that's something that we definitely will be checking in with them to see what is their timeline.
But they, you know, they I do know that they, you know, with all of the changes that are going on at the federal level, are encountering a lot of financial issues for themselves. And I will, with deep gratitude, say that they remain committed to the shared partnership under the bond and their delivery of the vouchers. And their, and in fact, they may act somewhat as more of a rent assistance mechanism, but we are committed together, and that they've been very clear with us about that, even though they themselves are facing a lot of financial uncertainty, and they're very committed to the bond, and we're really grateful for their partnership.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, thank you. And we've already covered the asset management process, so we are now at the moment and way ahead of time, which is fantastic, for public testimony. I don't know if we had anyone sign up. We checked. Thank you very much. For anyone who did, that remains.
I thought, wasn't Alan out in the...
He was, but yeah, there's
another meeting. I went to another meeting.
I know it's hard to believe.
Oh, so they just signed in.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think that's what it was.
Okay, perfect. Well, is there anyone who had any comment or question from the agenda committee? Fantastic.
Well, I'd just like to say I think you're all doing a really an incredible job with all that you have coming at you and all you're trying to track on. I really applaud you. I feel like the housing bond is in very good hands right now as we move forward. Yeah, I really appreciate your hard work.
We do have a comment from Leslie Goodlow, and they our business operations manager.
I just had a question, Jennifer, in regards to when we reach out to the community partners for
wait list.
Wait list. How are they notifying us before they send out to Craigslist or whatever to say whether or not they have enough?
We haven't had to go to that level, Leslie. I mean, quite frankly, the fact, you know, the 30% units are filling up as quickly, obviously, as we can get them with the homeless family system. And we've tried to make sure that we're not having to go to the public Craigslist with the list of referral partners. I have had the privilege of seeing some of the back data and about who's referring in, and a lot of partners from the homeless family system are referring at that 30 to 60 level. So it's Human Solutions. I don't think since we've initiated this process they've had to go to a Craigslist poster.
Okay, and that's fine. I'm just asking, who makes the decision whether they can or not? Is it
we do, okay. And so we spoke with them and said we want you to do 2 weeks of an open window to the contacts, these list of contacts that we want you to reach out to when you have when the wait list is opening. If you don't receive, you know, enough households on the wait list, I think that I'm trying to recall. I think it was like 25 or I don't know. We then they will notify us of that and say then we're going to proceed with opening it up, you know, to the broader public. So
25 is the number that
I believe that's
what the number we set. We have to have a clear policy in this MOU in place. We can't go make we are not allowed to make snap decisions based on the size of the list or who's referred. So this having this MOU in place that we've set up between Affinity and the various providers is important for us under fair housing law.
That's why I'm asking.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because I just want to make sure that
they're clear,
it's not
right.
Just their decision of when they get to now go to Craigslist, then they can avoid having to work with our partners. That's
right.
What I'm trying to find out.
Right. Yeah.
No, there's clear communication from Affinity to us as to when they're going to open up the waitlist, and that they sent it out, and they sent us a sample of what they sent out, and the time frame by which this opportunity is open. And before that gets closed out, they will send us another message saying, we don't have enough for the waitlist, this is what we're going to do unless you tell us otherwise. So there's clear they are expecting, and we want clear direction from us to them as to how we want them to list those units.
And are we going to do any, the compliance person in me, are we going to do any QA at all to go back to any of our partners and say, hey, did you make referrals? How many referrals did you make? Before we then say, yes, you can open it up, because, and maybe it's just I'm not being very, I don't trust right yet that folks are going to do stuff out of the goodness of their heart, that things don't get pushed to the side because they don't want to deal with lower income or homeless people or whatever
it is,
that we can ensure that that our partners did not send 25 because maybe somebody thought they sent something and it didn't show up or whatever. So it's just a thought. If that we haven't gotten to that part.
So we've asked Affinity to track, identify on the list of people they refer that apply for the wait list a referring source of organization that they may have been referred from. So from Affinity, we've asked them to track that. We have the list of contacts, agencies, and point people that are being contacted by Affinity that we can loop back with, I think, is you're proposing some additional. I think it's definitely, we need to It's just a thought for us to consider. Yeah, how to follow up through this process. The wait list is just opened. Actually, I think it was like yesterday, today. And so this is a perfect time right now for us to be tracking this very closely, both with the partners we've asked them to reach out to, as well as with Affinity.
And I think theoretically, it seems like given the tightness of the housing market, there would be something wrong if with all these partners, they didn't get enough referrals for the wait list. That would tell us
that would be the key.
Something maybe the partner agencies are understaffed, because usually you've got people in transitional housing. You've got households dangling. So the opportunity to get them on a wait list for a permanent placement is sort of golden.
Right.
So. Which is kind of what I was trying
to
say.
We need
if
to make.
If they say they didn't get 25, I would be very, very shocked.
And I would be happy to report that Darlington is 100% leased right now, and so there's no vacancies. There are people moving in over the next 3 weeks, but it's fully leased, and so they're opening up the wait list to just prepare for any new vacancies. But as it is right now, it's 100% leased.
Now, that said, though, anyone who does show up at the Allington and wants to go on the wait list goes on the wait list. I mean, no matter what we set up in terms of this policy,
Fair housing,
That's the way it works.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Thanks for being here today. Excellent meeting. Thanks for the work. Have a great afternoon.
Happy holidays.
I never.